You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a monthly program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You may have heard that I have left the library, but I have not left KPTZ. I hope to spend more time on more projects here at the radio station. And to kick it off, we are going to be talking to Northwest best-selling author and national best-selling author, Jess Walter. This year, he is the Huntingford Humanities Lecture Special Featured Guest, and that lecture is sponsored and hosted by the Jefferson County Library. This lecture was established in 2001 in memory of Sarah L. Huntingford. Sally, as she was known, was a longtime supporter of the Jefferson County Library. The library district was formed in 1978, due in part to her efforts. As a teacher and mom, Sally understood the importance of opening the door of learning to people who lived in isolated rural areas. She realized that quality library service was the key to that door. Last year, we got to hear Roz Chast. The year before, Karen Joy Fowler. And in years past, Garth Stein, Sherman Alexie, Timothy Egan. And so we are very pleased to have Jess join that list of wonderful authors here in the Northwest. Jess is the author of 8 books. We Live in Water is his most recent, published in 2013. And most of you have heard of and read Beautiful Ruins in 2012. He has also written a wonderful book called The Financial Lives of Poets, written in 2009, right during our financial breakdown across the country. And award-winning book, won an Edgar Award, Citizen Vince, in 2005. In 2006, he wrote The Zero, and we'll be talking about some of those books in this half hour. Welcome, Jess. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, I'd like you to start out, because you are from Spokane, and you still live there, I do believe.
I do.
From the last short story, or the last essay, in your book, We Live in Water, and that is the statistical abstract for my hometown. Would you be able to read that to us now?
Sure, yeah, I'll read from the beginning of that. It was an essay that I wrote for and published in McSweeney's, which my inspiration was the sort of statistical abstracts that counties release that explain a place through numbers, and I wanted a story to sort of slowly creep its way into this one. Statistical abstract for my hometown, Spokane, Washington. 1. The population of Spokane, Washington is 203,268. It is the 104th biggest city in the United States. 2. Even before the Great Recession in 2008, 36,000 people in Spokane lived below the poverty line, a little more than 18% of the population. That's about the same percentage as Washington, D.C. at the time. The poverty rate was 12.5% in Seattle. 3. Spokane is sometimes called the biggest city between Seattle and Minneapolis, but this is only true if you ignore everything below Wyoming, including Salt Lake City, Denver, Phoenix, and at least 4 cities in Texas. 4. This is really just another way of saying nobody much lives in Montana or the Dakotas. 5. My grandfather arrived in Spokane in the 1930s on a freight train he jumped near Fargo. Even he didn't want to live in the Dakotas. 6. On any given day in Spokane, Washington, there are more adult men per capita riding children's BMX bikes than in any other city in the world. 7. I've never been sure where these guys are going on these little bikes, their knees up around their ears as they pedal. They all wear hats. Ball caps in summer, stocking caps in winter. I've never been sure either whether the bikes belong to their kids or if they've stolen them. It may be that they just prefer BMX bikes to 10 speeds. Many of them have lost their driver's license after too many DUIs. 8. I was born in Spokane in 1965. Beginning in about 1978, when I was 13, I wanted to leave. 9. I'm still here.
We are talking to Jess Walter. He's the author of We Live in Water and six other books that we are happy to talk about today. You know, the New York Times called you, Jess, a ridiculously talented writer. The director of our library at Jefferson County, Meredith Wagner, says he continues to captivate readers with his poignant, witty, well-crafted stories about contemporary American life. Well, here you are, still in Spokane, but your writing spans all over the country. It's so diverse. Can you tell us a little bit about your pathway? Help us follow the pathway of Jess into being this very eclectic writer.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Yeah, it's strange because whatever path you take seems like the normal route to being a writer. But I think it wasn't until I was older that I realized that it was fairly unusual. I come from a very blue-collar family and was the first in my family to go to college. And so for me, I think becoming a writer was such a daydream and so unlikely that I still sometimes am surprised that I've been able to publish books. But I worked in journalism for about 7 years, worked for my hometown newspaper, the Spokesman Review in Spokane. And that was a great training ground, especially, you know, for a kid who wasn't going to be able to go off and get his MFA in creative writing the way a lot of students do. And I think I really got my chops as a journalist. I think it probably explains why I like a diverse style of writing. I like to write very different things. I like to get immersed in things the way I did as a journalist. My very first book was a nonfiction book about the standoff at Ruby Ridge, which came out of my reporting. And then 5 years after that, I was able to publish my first novel and have published six novels and a book of short stories since then.
I think of you as the real deal. You don't have the MFA. Well, because, you know, you didn't go to get your MFA kind of saying, well, if I don't get published or I'm not successful, I'll teach, right? Isn't that kind of the route?
Yeah. I think there is that path, you know, and I probably would have, honestly. I was a father at 19, and so that made a lot of my choices for me. I needed to support a child and support a family. And so I think in some ways I'm a little bit of a throwback. I've, working a job like that as a young father, living in your hometown, you know, I think but I also have a real soft spot for writers who, you know, maybe who don't come from wealth, who's, you know, to get an MFA, it's a $30,000 to $50,000 graduate degree with no guarantee of a job afterwards.
Mm-hmm,
it was difficult enough for my family to pay for me to get a BA in college. I ended up having to pay for my own school. And so, you know, imagining getting a degree that would cost something like that, I think, you know, in these times when economic inequity is so stark, when the gap between wealth and poverty is so strong, we're in danger of having writers that can only afford to come from the upper class.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, you know, coming from a blue-collar working-class background, I think that was just always going to be the route to becoming a writer. In many ways, though, I feel like writers who come through journalism have a real advantage. I think they're really outward-looking. You know, I tend not to sit around and write stories about, you know, about myself, I suppose, the way maybe some writers would.
Mm-hmm. I think you take what's happening in our culture today and what's happening in the news and jump from there. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I've certainly tried to do that in the past. You know, I've written novels about the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the Zero, about the financial crisis. And I do think, you know, in my journalism training, when I look at the world, I want to reflect what's happening back at us. And it does draw me in. Even the stories in We Live in Water really come out of that period when, during the economic crisis, when, you know, it felt as if, you know, for a while there, we were all afraid we were headed for another depression. And you know, I remember just for myself waking up one morning and there's a bus stop across from our house and a homeless person had taken up residence on the bench by our right by our house. And, you know, we can look at numbers and see that the unemployment rate is falling, and we can, you know, median income can be going up. And yet there are still people who, you know, for whom this economy is a really harsh thing.
Let's talk some more about this collection of short stories. How did you choose these particular stories? Was there a theme? It is not, I must admit, the genre that I usually read, because I'm a mom and I have two sons that are young adults, and these kind of stories kind of put me on edge a little bit. I must admit. But the more I read them, I started to see into these people's lives. They weren't so scary.
Yeah, it's funny to me how disturbing these stories can be to people. I think we're terribly afraid of the floor caving in on us, on losing the safety net that we have. And the stories in We Live in Water were sort of inspired by something that happened. Me and my wife and I were out to dinner, and we were headed out to dinner, and there was a woman standing near a liquor store who was panhandling, and we were walking by, and she said, "I've been kicked out of my house, and I have three children, and I need to feed them. Could you give me some money?" And I never know what to do with panhandlers. Like a lot of people, you know, you don't want to be giving someone money to feed their addiction. We were right next to a liquor store. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure why, but something in the woman seemed compelling, and I gave her $5. And my wife and I went to the restaurant. We were sitting there, and I was thinking, I wonder why I did that. You know, she's probably, you know, just trying to get booze or something. And as we were sitting in the restaurant, I looked out, and the woman went walking down the street with grocery bags followed by three kids. And just that stark moment of realizing my first reaction had been suspicion. Mm-hmm. And as the economy was falling apart around us, I began thinking about the Great Depression, when one-fourth of all men were out of work and women weren't even in the workforce. And so it seemed to me we had some shift as Americans where we'd begun to blame ourselves. We'd begun to blame people for their own poverty. And this seemed to me like a failure of empathy. And so almost all the stories in We Live in Water began to revolve around the people we drive past, who we don't notice, who we look the other way. There's a story in the beginning with a panhandler holding out a sign that says anything helps. And that panhandler tells the truth about what he's going to buy with the money, and no one believes him, much like I hadn't believed that woman. There's another story about two meth addicts trying to pawn a giant television. And the thing I really tried to do in all those stories...
Was that one of the witty stories, Jess?
What's that?
Was that one of the witty stories? It starts out, it sounds sort of funny that, you know, they're trying...
Yeah. Well, it was important to me that all these stories connect with what I look for, which is a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood, and there were times when my dad was laid off, and for a while we lived in a house that we had to heat with a wood stove with no indoor plumbing, and we had an incredible sense of humor. My dad has always been one of the funniest people that I've ever known, and a lot of the people I grew up with. And to me, that's the most humanizing thing, that ability, you know, to laugh. There's a moment in that story, Wheelbarrow Kings, the two meth addicts are trying to sell the big TV, where they laugh and laugh about the adventures they've had that day. And one of them says that when they were doing these things, it wasn't that funny, but now it seems so hilarious, and he thinks maybe remembering is better than living. And that's what I keep looking for, are those sort of thematic connections. And that's what really the story collection was about, was finding both humor and the kind of emotional moments. A lot of these characters are fathers trying to be the best dads they can be in difficult situations. You know, many of them have lost jobs and houses, and those were the kind of people I wanted to write about.
The title itself, I'm thinking someone wanted me to ask you, is it a planetary title, or is it something to do with being underwater, because we always talked about that with the mortgages and not just quite making it in life? What were you thinking when you chose that title?
All of those things. A lot of times I'll look for a title that resonates in one or two or three different ways. With Beautiful Ruins, for instance, the title refers to the ruins of Italy, but also to the lives of the characters, to a state of ruination that we all arise at, where we have scars from the things we've done and the mistakes we've made, but there's a sense of dignity and beauty that kind of rises up. And with We Live in Water, there's a short story, the title story is refers directly to a boy who imagines our lives as he's looking into an aquarium, and he's watching the fish swim around and bounce against these invisible walls and seem to make the same mistake every time. And he wonders if we have free choice, if we have free will. And there's a part of that story where one of the characters is remembering being on an aircraft carrier. And the way he describes it is the blue sky and the ocean, and where the blue sky and the ocean met was this endless line. And then everything that wasn't sky or water lived for a moment in that little gray band above and below it, the blue stretched on forever. And for me, that's where these stories take place. They take place in that little band of life in which we are trying to keep our heads above water economically, emotionally. It can be hard to be a human being. And for me, that's what these people are struggling with. They're in that small band where we live our lives.
In Port Townsend, we look at that small band a lot, living here on the seacoast and the sky. And so I will think of your description. I just wanted to say, everyone, that you are listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and this is KPTZ 91.9 FM right here in Port Townsend. We're talking to the Huntingford Lecture special guest this year, author Jess Walter, and he is going to be appearing at Chimicum High School Auditorium. It's a free event, and it will be October 1st at 6:30, and I hope that you either have joined us or will join us, and if you can't, then you will pick up one of these wonderful books that we're talking about. Continuing to talk to Jess, you have written so many diverse books. You are not formulaic, and you're not following the current advice of the publishing world by doing this, sticking to one genre and letting people know, you know, what to expect. So you've also been called, or did you call yourself, a dirty realist? That's not exactly my genre. So I'd like you to talk about who are the dirty realists and how do you fit in there?
The dirty realists. I don't think I am a dirty realist. I play on a literary basketball team with Sherman Alexie and Shan Ray and a couple of other writers. And we jokingly called ourselves the Spokane Dirty Realists.
Oh, well, there you go.
If anything, if the stories in We Live in Water, some of them might qualify as dirty realism, although there's also a zombie story, and I think the stories are humorous. But dirty realism was a literary movement that came about, in the 80s, maybe late 70s, 80s. Raymond Carver, of course, Northwest writer, I think, is probably the writer most closely associated with that movement. Richard Ford's short stories. And basically, you know, the dirty part of it is is this idea that, you know, life can be messy in much the same way that you know, painters at one time could only paint nobility. There was an idea that in American fiction, we were consumed with the lives of the wealthy and the famous and the fabulous, and that there were these smaller lives and these smaller moments. And so dirty realists tended to write minimal stories, much shorter, not as ornate. And so I do think these stories in We Live in Water harken back to a kind of dirty realism, but I think my own particular style, I tend not to want to be pegged or boiled down to any one genre or style or system.
Are your editors and the publishing house kind of saying, well, next you have to have like a follow-up of some other glamorous place in Europe? How about Serbia?
You know, one of the great things about having a writing career at Spokane, Washington is that I don't really have any idea what the publishing industry wants or doesn't want, and I've always just written the next book I want to read, and I wish it were, you know, that I could teach a class on how to become a best-selling novelist, but I assure you it was entirely accidental and unintentional, and anything that I did, only driven by the desire to tell a story, and that's still what drives me. So general, if there's something that is smart for a writer's career, I've tended to work against it. And yet I think that is, in a way, the best way to be a writer, to not think of it as a career, but think of it almost as a religion, as a passion. That's the way I've always approached it.
We better talk about Beautiful Ruins here, because you certainly followed your muse there, and I think I read that you worked on it on and off for a long time. So, first of all, I mean, it really is an incredible bestseller, and I'll tell you, it's not the picture on the cover, because I read, you know, an early review in, you know, kind of a professional review magazine, and it's, first of all, Cinque Terre, the setting, and then your characters. You know, every book group in the whole country wanted to read this book and discuss it. So there you go. The women readers have risen and decided that this is a great book for them. And we all enjoyed it here in Port Townsend. I'll tell you that it's part of a set of books that we loan out from the library to book groups. I want to talk to you about that book and how you started to write it and kind of how it ended up to, you know, there's so many wonderfully interesting characters. They're all in different times and different pathways, but it sort of starts in the early 60s. Is that correct, with the filming of Cleopatra?
Yeah. The place the novel started for me was in 1997. Mm-hmm. I began working on it. I went to Italy with my wife, who is second generation Italian and has cousins up and down the boot. And I'd never been to Italy, so it was terrific. I loved it, and I loved the Cinque Terre. It was one of the most romantic places. And I thought I want to write a novel about this place. And I chose the 1960s first because I wanted a time before the Cinque Terre was really discovered by Rick Steves and others, other travel writers. And so I wanted a time when it was less spoiled, I guess, by tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
so I chose the 1960s sort of randomly, and then had to say, now, who is this woman? I had this vision of a woman arriving in the cliffside villages of Italy, where you could only arrive by boat. And then I had to do what fiction writers often do, which is say, who is this person? Who are these people that I'm seeing? And right away, there was an innkeeper, Pasquale Tursi, who, like me, had lived his whole life in one town and dreamt of bigger and better things. And then there was this beautiful woman, and I decided she would be an actress. And so the next question was to ask myself what an actress would be doing in Italy in the 1960s. And fiction writing is often that sort of researching rabbit hole where that leads you into Cleopatra, and the next thing you know, you're putting Richard Burton in your novel.
Everyone loves Pasquale. He's kind of he's the pivoting point, I guess, or the non-artist. He's a dreamer, and he's just so lovely. But there's also Claire, Michael Dean, Shane. It kind of jumps around from Hollywood and then trying to make it as a rocker in Seattle. How did all of those plot lines get woven in? It's complicated.
It is. It is. In some ways, it is a complicated story. In other ways, it's a really simple story. I always imagined the novel begins with Pasquale and Dee, these two young people meeting in Italy in 1964. And really, the structure of the novel just follows those two characters, mm-hmm. 50 years later, finding out what happened to them in their various lives. Most stories move sort of along a plane, along a line. I always felt like this story was moving in depth. But I started working on it in 1997, and it was another 14 or 15 years before I finished it. And in that time, I wrote five other books, and I would always return to Beautiful Ruins. And each time I did, there would be these other characters whose stories I wanted to tell. And the novel itself quickly became a novel about storytelling. As you said, Pasquale is the only non-artist in the book. every other character is involved in the process of telling their lives through some kind of art. There are filmmakers and a playwright and even an artist who paints on the walls of a machine gun bunker, and of course writers. And Pasquale is the one person whose life is really his work of art. And so as the novel evolved, it really became about the act of storytelling itself. And the stories that the people tell became the beautiful ruins of the title. And so there, one rail of the story is set in present-day Hollywood, and the other rail sort of follows the 1960s. And we basically bounce back and forth, although I can be pretty playful as a writer, so I liked venturing into all different directions.
I definitely related to Pasquale and also to Dee's son, because I also have a son who's a musician and trying to make it in this world as an artist. In fact, I did want to talk about sort of you and Sherman Alexie and your podcast, too, before we go.
Sure.
It's called A Tiny Sense of Accomplishment. And you mentioned that you met Sherman way back when you were both writing for the newspaper. Is that correct?
Yeah. My family actually lived near Springdale and Hunters, which is right off the Spokane Indian Reservation. So there's a good chance Sherman and I met, you know, as 10-year-olds at the Springdale powwow and rodeo or in a basketball game. But so we'd sort of always, we're about the same age and kind of always revolved around each other. But we met sort of formally at the newspaper as young 20s, guys in their early 20s or maybe even 20. We were both pretty young. And we were interns, and a mutual friend knew that we both wanted to be writers and so introduced us. And yeah, we've had this great friendship. There are about four of us writers who share emails and share work and catch up with how things are going. And, you know, we've gotten to know each other's families. And the podcast was kind of a way for Sherman and I to have our friendship publicly in a way. We now, when we see each other, it tends to be to tape the podcast. So what you're hearing is often the two of us catching up with each other and sharing in each other's successes and in the difficulties and frustrations of being a writer, of being an aging basketball player, of being parents. And so yeah, it's been a fun thing, and it's been, you know, it's been great. We just taped a live one, which is sort of our favorite thing to do. We can both be hams on stage, and we just taped one at Bumbershoot.
Oh,
yeah,
fun.
Yeah. We have musical guests.
So we need to tell people how they find this.
You'll need a fancy computer or any computer,
yes.
And then you can just Google either of our names and podcast, and it will pop up. It's called A Tiny Sense of Accomplishment.
But you don't need to remember.
It's on the Infinite Guest podcast network. So you can also go to American Public Media, APM.com, Infinite Guest. But the easiest thing to do is just to Google.
That's how I found it. I had a podcast app, and I just brought it up. So I think our listeners would find that fun to listen to. I just want to say that it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And also, I want everyone to, if you haven't read one of Jess's books, to pick one up. And please, if you're hearing this before October 1st, please come and meet him in person at Chimicum High School, October 1st at 6:30. It is a free event sponsored by the Jefferson County Library. You have been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. Today we talked to Jess Walter, author of Beautiful Ruins, his most recent book, We Live in Water. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. I'd like to thank the man in the booth, Mike Schlexer. We'll see you next time.